Hitler's Defense, February 26, 1924. It seems strange to me that a man who, as a soldier, became accustomed to blind obedience for nearly 6 years, should suddenly come into conflict with the state and its constitution. To explain this, I must go back to my youth, because there indeed is the seed of the conflict between me and today's constitution and governing bodies. As a young man of 16½ years of age, I was forced to earn my own bread. I came to Vienna when I was barely 17, and there I became thoroughly acquainted with three things. First, the social question. For the first time there, I felt the great misery and hardship of the broad masses of society firsthand. Secondly, the racial problem in the city, where East and West more or less meet. In Vienna, one can study the racial problem better than anywhere in Germany, because there, according to my political conviction, the greatest enemy and adversary of all Aryan humanity emerges more strongly and sharply than in Munich or in the rest of Germany in general. Thirdly, in Austria, I became acquainted with that movement which was founded by a certain race and which exploits the great needs of the broad masses in order to build up an organization whose consequences would inevitably lead to the collapse of the entire modern state, that is, the Marxist movement. I arrived in Vienna a cosmopolitan and left an out-and-out anti-Semite and a mortal enemy of the entire Marxist worldview. I then came to Munich and earned my bread here until the war came. I was convinced that the fate of Germany and that of German Austria would not be decided in the Austrian army, but in the German army. Accordingly, I enlisted for service in the latter. When it was announced on November 7th, 1918 that the revolution had broken out in Munich, I couldn't believe it at first. But by November 9th it became clear to me, and that night my decision was made. The great vacillation in my life, whether I would turn to politics or whether I would remain a builder, came to an end. I decided that night that if I got my vision back, I would turn to politics. I came to Munich, and a few weeks later, I was with a reserve battalion. My further political development was relatively simple. I was active during the period of the Council Republics, and as a result of my resistance during the Council period, came to the attention of my superiors, and was invited into the Intelligence Commission of Infantry Regiment the 2nd. Here I came into contact with the National Socialist German Workers' Party. At that time it was still called the German Workers' Party. The movement had 6 members, I was the 7th. The Marxist movement works with 2 powerful instruments. On the one hand, it employs an enormous propaganda apparatus with mass influence. The bourgeoisie does not understand Marxism, does not know that the little boy who is taken out of school and inducted into this doctrine is thereby ultimately alienated from the state and society and, if this is consistently continued, soon becomes ripe to enter the trade unions as an apprentice. How he then becomes further and further alienated from his people, relies exclusively on manual labor, fundamentally rejects the intellect as bourgeois, and that this doctrine will lead to a monstrous force within the state, to a confrontation of the brute fist against genius and knowledge. Through this doctrine, it becomes possible for a man of 30 to 40 years of age to become a mortal enemy of his own brother, to call the comrades of his own German blood mortal class enemies, while he regards our real enemies, the English and French, or even the Hottentots who are completely racially foreign to him, as brothers. The second instrument of this movement is an unprecedented terror. No movement has operated with such thorough knowledge of the nature of the masses as the Marxist movement. It knows that the masses have respect for strength and determination, and it has substituted brute power and brute will for the weakness and indecisiveness of the bourgeoisie, has ruthlessly subordinated the individual, and given the workers an ultimatum: either you be my brother, or I'll stove your skull in. At first I was fighting a losing battle. Nevertheless, in the course of a few years, a movement has emerged from that small group of 6 men, which today comprises millions, and which, above all, has made the broad masses national-minded again. We were clear that we could not get by with the old methods of whining and pleading. A government cannot protect an intellectual movement. Therefore, we decided on the following principle. For those who are willing to fight with intellectual weapons, we have the intellect. For the others, we have our fists. Our propaganda machine was joined by the Sturmabteil in order to prevent our movement from being terrorized and our supporters from being crushed. There were places where we could not hold a meeting for a long time. The SA had no military significance. Its sole purpose was to be an organization capable of meeting terror from the left, with even greater terror from our side. Until 1923, the SA never deviated from this purpose. In 1923 came a great, bitter scandal. We had already realized in 1922 that the Ruhr would be lost. France's aim was not only to weaken Germany, but to break it up into small states in order to be able to hold the Rhine region. We knew, after the repeated declarations of weakness, that after the Saar region and after Upper Silesia, we would also lose our third coal basin, the Ruhr, one loss after another. Our movement was thus at loggerheads with the bourgeois world for the first time. The Folkish movement realized that the Ruhr could not be preserved by mere passive resistance, but only by reawakening the national will to resist. An active front in this sense had to be built up behind the Ruhr. This was impossible as long as the truce was maintained, which had already broken the neck of the German people in 1914. We too wanted a united front, but not between people of whom one was prepared to climb the redoubt and sacrifice his life, while the other would stab him in the back. Only fervent, ruthless, brutal fanaticism could have saved the situation at that time. The Reich government would have had to let the hundreds of thousands of young men who came home from the Ruhr to the Reich under the old colors of black, white, and red flow together in a powerful national wave. In countless public rallies, we advocated national revival. Instead, these young people were sent back. The government reduced the national resistance to a paid general strike. They forgot that an enemy like France cannot be prayed to death, still less lazed to death. Billions were thrown into this useless resistance. The German financial system was torn apart, and the conditions were created for the formation of those factions who, because they had forgotten how to work, because they had not been educated to be willing to make sacrifices, later attacked us as separatists. The national will, the great uprising of the nation, was allowed to wither and dry up, just as it did in 1914. At that time, I went to Otto Hermann von Lossow and explained to him that the resistance could only be led from the nationalist side. We must therefore vigorously support these elements. Our youth has only one thought, and let this be heard in Paris, that the day will come when we are free again. Lossow said at the time that there were two possibilities: either to support the resistance in an energetic form, or, if the whole thing fell apart, each state would have to look after itself. That, of course, would lead to the destruction of the Reich. I was inwardly very disturbed by this at the time, for my attitude is that I would rather be hanged if Germany should turn Bolshevik than perish under the rule of French swords. It was then that the inner conversion of our movement took place, as is also emphasized in the indictment. The development of events in the Ruhr conflict proved us right. It showed that the backstabbers were more powerful than ever. On May 1st, we tried to see to it that at least in one town, the Soviet flag could no longer be flown. The authorities opposed us for the first time. They protected the Soviet flag. After that, I did not go to the military district command anymore, since I saw that further talks were worthless. With pride, I confess that it was our people who put up the only real resistance in the Ruhr. We wanted to initiate a propaganda campaign throughout Germany in a series of 14 meetings with the slogan, "Down with the Ruhr traitors," but a ban on these meetings took us by surprise. I had met Herr von Kahr in 1920. It was also after a putsch that he ascended to his ministerial chair. Kahr had given me the impression that he was an honorable civil servant. I spoke to Kahr for the first time when it was a question of disarming the Einwohnerwehr. I implored Kahr not to disarm the Einwohnerwehr, because that would mean the loss of Upper Silesia. Herr von Kahr assured me that he would never agree to the Einwohnerwehr being disarmed, that we could rest assured with him. A few days later, the Einwohnerwehr was disbanded. I spoke with Kahr briefly a second time in a private conversation, but not since. It is not enough for a statesman to have a clean record. Before the war, that was what was demanded of the lowest civil servant. Kahr did not have other qualities that one must demand of a statesman in this situation. He did not have the iron fist to impose order. If Carr had capable people behind him, he could achieve great things. But it was Perner standing behind him at that time. It was Perner, not Carr, who did the work back then. Von Carr did not seem to me personally the man to fulfill the great expectations of the German people. He will, I said to myself, take a giant run-up, only to collapse when the fight is about to begin. I went to Losso. I explained to him that I was not coming to him from political motives, because in my eyes he was politically a dead man. Losso had indeed refused to obey the head of the Reichswehr, and it was naivete to think that there was any other remedy than overthrowing him or fighting for what was right. Ludendorff was also convinced of this, saying, "What Losso is doing is a battle from which he can only emerge victorious or fallen." I explained to Losso at the time that I personally regarded the matter as a tremendous misfortune. The people had expected a gigantic wave. They had believed that the collapse would become the cause of a flood, which would gradually take hold of the whole German people and drive out the Marxist International. From the struggle against Marxism, from the gigantic uprising, a dictatorship was to rise. Now a man came and immediately declared himself dictator. Herr von Kahr could not fulfill the hopes placed in him. He was quite incapable of doing so. No one will dispute his outstanding human qualities. But I already said at the time that what is being demanded now is something else. The struggle against Berlin, as led by Herr von Kahr, is a crime unless one is determined to face the consequences, to incorporate the struggle into the German national uprising from the first minute on. I said that they had now turned the matter into a Bavarian rejection of Berlin's demands. The people, however, had expected something other than a beer price reduction, a milk price decree, a butter barrel confiscation, and similar impossible economic measures, where one had to ask oneself which genius had been consulted. Every failure was bound to increase the anger of the masses, and I pointed out that people would make fun of Carr's measures now and be outraged later. I told Lossau, if you lead the struggle to its end, then there can only be a political and military offensive. If you cross the Rubicon, you must also march on Rome, or if you don't want the struggle, then there is only surrender. The struggle was to be directed northwards. It could not be led by a purely Bavarian organization. It only promised success if it was led by a force that could be seen as the coming German National Army. Herr von Losso recognized this as correct and asked me whom I had in mind. I explained, you and Seisser must lead the fight yourselves, but Ludendorff comes to mind as the only man for the top. I had seen Ludendorff in the field for the first time in 1918, and in 1921 I was able to speak to him personally for the first time. I realized that he was not only the most outstanding general in the field, but that he had now also relearned and recognized the reasons that had brought the German nation to its downfall. The fact that Ludendorff was being pulled down by the others was one more reason for me to join him more closely. So I proposed Ludendorff, and Lossau and Seisser had no objection. I further explained to Lossau that nothing could be achieved now with petty economic means. The struggle is with Marxism. To solve this problem, you don't need administrators, you need firebrands who are able to inflame national enthusiasm to the utmost. Carr could not do that. The youth was not behind him. I could join, I declared, only on the condition that the political struggle be placed exclusively in my hands. But that was not impudent or immodest of me. I am rather of the opinion that when a man knows that he alone can do a thing, he must not be modest. When Lossau spoke of a coup d'etat, when Carr openly declared that he would give the signal to strike, this can only be interpreted as meaning that these people wanted to strike but always lost their nerve. Our last conversation on November 6th was basically nothing more than the absolute confirmation of my conviction. The gentleman wanted to do it, but kept backing out. Lossau declared on November 6th that he was ready for a coup d'etat under certain conditions. Now, it goes without saying that if a man does not find the courage to break loose, he cannot tell the others to break loose either. But we had to be convinced that the gentlemen were only waiting for a push. Our people and public opinion were pushing, and Herr Lossau and Herr Seisser only wanted a broadening of the foundation. So we were convinced that action would only be taken if the will came along with the want, so to speak. If, on the other hand, the matter was postponed, then things could pop off at a less favorable time, because our people could no longer be held back. In addition, Lossau had said that if the North did not strike out on its own, separation could not be avoided. I also remember the conversation with Lossau during the Ruhr movement, where he hinted that a foreign power might get involved. That's why it seemed to me that if the North were to give the impetus, things would be good. If it didn't, then perhaps the impetus would come from a faction that would let things fizzle out. Therefore, the only option was to give the impetus myself. That is why I decided, with two other gentlemen, whose names I will not mention, to give this impetus. We held a meeting the next day in which we agreed on the plan. I was immediately of the opinion that only a very few should be privy to the plan. I did not have to fear that afterwards I would be reproached for not having told the people beforehand what I intended to do, for all the gentlemen had expected nothing else. They hoped from hour to hour that salvation would come. All the older gentlemen who had families were not informed. When I spoke to Schubner about whether Ludendorff should be informed, he explained that no, Ludendorff, as an officer, must not know anything about it. On the afternoon of November 7th, I held the definitive and decisive meeting with the gentlemen, and the date of November 8th was finally fixed, because, as we had learned by chance at the last moment, Carr was to hold a meeting on November 8th. That seemed to be the opportune moment to create this fait accompli most easily, and it was decided that the hall should be surrounded by our shock troops, that Losso, Carr, and Caesar should be called out for a meeting, on the telephone or in some other way, that the hall should not be occupied, and that they should be told very briefly. Your Excellency sees that this is a fait accompli. Now face the consequences from your previous speeches. There is no going back for you either way, but there is no going back for us either. We were of the opinion that what had been discussed for months would either be carried out by men or rejected by cowards. The event itself, put very briefly, went as follows. I went to the Bürgerbräu Keller at 8 o'clock in the evening. There was a large crowd of people outside, and at first I thought that perhaps the police had somehow caught wind of the matter. I saw a large police detachment. Another large police detachment was marching up from the bridge, and I knew that some of our shock troops were arriving in passenger cars. Whether the police had any idea of what was going on, I could not determine at first. In any case, I went in and left my companion, Herr Graf, who knew nothing about the matter, and simply told him, "When the shock troops arrive, go into the antechamber and wait for me. I'll be in there." I went in and saw that the hall was overcrowded. I was let in because the police officers knew me. I immediately recognized that with this overcrowding, it was completely impossible to ask the gentlemen to leave. It had been decided beforehand that I was to sit down at the table near the podium, but it was not even possible to get to the table. Then the gentlemen were to be asked to come out, and I was to follow. That was quite impossible. No one could get in, not even by elbowing their way in. I immediately exited the hall again. The speech Herr von Kahr was giving was incomprehensible. There was now a feeling that, as things stood, a provocation might occur under certain circumstances. I went into the antechamber and told Schubner to go immediately to Ludendorff and inform him. If Ludendorff did not want to come, I asked him to telephone me. I would then drive out myself. But I thought it impossible that Ludendorff would not do so if I asked him personally. Schubner then went out but came back and explained that the street outside the hall was full of people. Whether our shock troops would come was still a big question. I asked a police officer to have the street cleared, otherwise riots could break out in the hall. The police officer went out and cleared the street. I went into the hall at 8:34 p.m. with three men, my constant companions. We had a pistol with us, since it could not be ruled out that we would be shot at. The fact that we did not use the pistol to threaten Carr was due to the fact that he did not appear to us in this environment as a terrible man who could only be kept in check by force of arms. Rather, he stood on his podium, trembling and pale. I went in and got some quiet by shooting my pistol in the air. It was in the nature of things that I had to fire this shot, and only a gentleman who reads his speeches from drafts written by others could fail to understand such a thing. I then asked Carr, Lossau, and Seisser to come out. Then I was confronted by an officer. I found out later that it was Major Hunglinger. He had his hand in his pocket, and I had a feeling he was drawing a pistol. I held the gun up to his head and told him to take his hand out of his pocket. Nobody dared push my hand away. Hunglinger pulled his hand out, and I lowered the pistol again. I then asked Herr Carr, Herr Losso, and Herr Seisser to come out under the assurance that I would personally guarantee their safety. I was as much in control of my senses on that day as on any other day. I then led the gentleman out into the antechamber. There was a line of blue-clad police facing 6 to 8 of us. I then cleared the antechamber and led the gentleman in. Carr was so dejected and broken that I felt truly sorry for him. I felt even sorrier for Cesaire and von Lossow that I had to lead 2 officers out of the hall. I immediately apologized for this and said, "Please forgive me for having to proceed in this way, but I have no other choice. The matter is now settled. There is no going back." The few sentences reported to the public are partly fabricated and also partly taken out of context. His Excellency von Carr supposedly stated, "To live or not to live, to die or not to die, is all the same to me." But in reality, Herr von Carr did not stand there in a heroic pose during these minutes. I assured him once again that there was not the slightest danger to his life. That was when Carr said that he was not afraid of that either, because to live or not to live was all the same to him. I answered Carr by pointing to the pistol I had in my hand and smiling. "There are 5 shots in it, 4 for the traitors, and if it goes wrong, 1 for me." I gave Graf the pistol to load to replace the fired cartridge. We did not threaten the gentlemen, but I reminded them of what they had discussed with us all along and asked them to face the consequences now. There would be no turning back, or we would perish, although back then I assumed that they would go to prison with us if the whole thing fell apart, an opinion which I must correct today. I asked the gentlemen to assume their new offices. Carr raised the following objection. He said, "Yes, but one must also have an inner satisfaction in the matter, and after the way you led me out of the hall, people will not believe that I am doing this of my own accord. You didn't even let me finish my speech." I said, "Well, I had no idea that your speech would last so long." I then went out and made sure that all the shock troops had arrived. Then I went back inside. But since Carr declared that he feared that the proceedings in the hall might be misunderstood, I said to him, "Please, if you have reservations, I am prepared to go into the hall and speak. I will suggest in the hall that Herr von Carr will take over, and there will then be thunderous applause. You will not be blamed for this. On the contrary, the people are waiting for it." So I went into the hall and briefly explained that a decision would be made in the antechamber as to whether Herr von Carr, Lossow, and Cesaire were prepared to accept the new government. I explained that the gentlemen were struggling with their decision, and that I considered it necessary for those assembled to decide whether they agreed with the proposed solution. There was an unheard of applause in the hall, an incredible storm. I went out and said, "Your Excellency von Carr, you may rest assured you need not be ashamed in front of the people. When you come in, you won't be mocked. On the contrary, they will carry you on their shoulders." In the meantime, Ludendorff arrived. He asked me whether the gentleman had been informed of his coming. Then he explained that he was just as surprised as the others, but that the only possible decision had to be taken. What came next was self-evident. On our side, it was certain that a struggle against the Reichswehr and the police was out of the question, for these were the 2 factors which were to bring about the change. Without these 2 factors, the whole thing was futile. As long as we did not have the absolute conviction that Lossow, Cesar, and Carr did not want to take part in the matter out of their innermost convictions, we were obliged to carry out the matter honorably. It was therefore not out of recklessness that we held our ground at the morning meeting. The people stood up for us, as they are still standing up for us now, and will always stand up for us. The prisons to which our comrades are sent will become places of honor for the German youth. Even in the early morning, we did not receive any message that brought us positive clarity. Not even by noon was any communication brought to us. There were only 2 options, either to take the matter beyond Munich, or to stay in Munich and appeal to public opinion again. Ludendorff therefore said himself, "We are going into the city in order to win public opinion, to see how public opinion reacts, and how then Carr, Lossow, and Cesar react to public opinion. For they could not be so unreasonable as to take action with machine guns against the rebelling people." So the decision was made to march into the city. We took the lead. After all, we don't do it like the communists, who seek cover in the rear when their men take to the barricades. My attention was drawn to the fact that I should inform Ludendorff that we might be shot at. I did so, but Ludendorff only replied, "We march." We marched on. Ludendorff, Dr. Weber on his right, myself on his left, then Dr. Schubner and the other gentlemen. As we advanced, green-clad police met us on the Ludwig Bridge, racking their bolts sharply and aiming their rifles at us. We marched on, and they dispersed. They were not disarmed at that moment by advanced disarming squads. If a man has his rifle ready to fire, he cannot be disarmed by another. He already has the advantage over him. Rather, they were deeply shaken, to be in such discord with everyone. They put down their rifles and stood aside. There were people with tears rushing into their eyes who were completely broken. Our people marched through, and it would have been difficult for them to shoot. If people were being disarmed in the rear, we did not see that in the front. On the contrary, there were individual shouts from civilians who joined in on the left and right and marched along, some of them pushing their way in. We shouted back, "Don't do anything. The police didn't do anything to us. We have no reason to harm them." The people then immediately stepped back. There were young men of 19 or 20 among them, recruits. You could imagine what a task it was for them to stand against us. They saw men facing them, many of whom had their chests covered with badges of honor from the World War. It was not necessary to go out of our way to harm them. We arrived at Marienplatz. The enthusiasm was unparalleled, and on this march I recognized that the people were behind us. They recognized that this state of affairs could no longer continue. They could no longer be put off with ridiculous half-resolutions and decisions. The people wanted those who once committed the monstrous crime 5 years ago to be called to account. They wanted a reckoning with the November criminals. That is what the people of Munich want, as far as they have a sense for the honor and dignity of human life, and not for slavery. That was the wish of the broad masses, which resulted in an incredible storm of applause. We marched on and finally came to the residence. Here, too, the same picture. A very weak police cordon had immediately dispersed. People stood aside. Some even shouted, "Heil!" Others didn't know what to make of it. I must emphasize that everyone that marched forth with us was practically a civilian. Even Ludendorff went in civilian clothes. I had nothing but my raincoat, though I did have my armband. As usual, I wore my pistol strapped on the outside, not in my hand, but in my holster. It wouldn't have done me any good either. Ludendorff put his hands in his coat pockets. There was no one carrying a pistol, still less a rifle. In front were the two flag bearers, the only soldiers, on the left and on the right an attendant, no one else. We were all more or less unarmed. That's how we arrived. A few meters from us, I saw a short standstill and heard a shot. We had the feeling that the cordon, which had now become stronger, suddenly swarmed out at the Feldherrenhalle. I thought they were Reichswehr because of the steel helmets, and stretched across the street in a triple line. So we linked arms in order to press forward, for the fact that we would march through was a matter of course. At that moment, a shot rang out. Not a pistol shot, but a rifle or carbine shot. One would trust a soldier who has heard shooting for 4 years to be able to distinguish the slight bark of a pistol from a rifle shot. It is indecent to make such an assertion. It was not a pistol shot, but a rifle or carbine shot. Immediately afterwards, a volley cracked. I had the feeling at that moment that I had been shot in the left side. Dr. Schubner, whose arm was linked with mine, fell to the ground, and I fell with him. I now felt as if I had dislocated my left arm from Dr. Schubner's fall. Then a second salvo cracked, and I had the feeling that I had taken a bullet to my left arm, because my first injury in the war had felt more like a blow than a cut. I lay there for only a few seconds, and immediately tried to pull myself together again. The shooting stopped again. When I got up, there was only a little shooting, a single man shooting from Praising Alley. All I saw around me were dead and wounded, a single field of blood. In front of me were state police, some of them with weapons at the ready and armored cars. Behind me, 70 or 80 meters further back, were our last men in the rear. I could not see Ludendorff anywhere. I had not fallen forward but backwards, sideways. I only saw a tall gentleman in a black coat stained with blood, half covered, and now, without a clear thought, I was convinced at first that it was Ludendorff. At that moment I was faced with the question of whether to give myself up or go to the back, 80 meters to the last people behind me. I went to the back. There were still some shots from the residence, which is now no longer disputed, then from Praising Lane, as well as from the front, and perhaps also from our side some more stray shots. I went back and got into a car at the square near the revenue office. My whole left side felt paralyzed, and I was convinced that I had been shot. I couldn't go into a house in Munich because I would have been recognized and arrested immediately due to my notoriety. I therefore told the driver to leave Munich and only return at night, for I did not know what kind of wound I had. In the woods, a doctor who had come with me examined me. He told me I was not wounded, but apparently had a dislocation. We drove to Uffing, and I stayed there for 3 days. The doctor tried to set my arm. Later, it turned out that I had a broken joint and a broken collarbone. During these days, I was at first overcome by physical and emotional pain, especially because at first I feared that Ludendorff was dead. Only later did I learn through conversation in Uffing that Ludendorff was alive. On Sunday, I arrived in Landsberg after I had been surrounded by a crew of trucks and arrested after long preparations. In Landsberg, I received newspapers over the next few days. There I was able to read that I was not a man of my word, that I had given Herr von Kahr my word of honor, that I would never do anything without informing him, and even more, I had given him this word personally on the evening of November 6th, 1923. It was all printed in black and white in front of me. Supposedly, I even declared in the next room, "Yes, I broke my word," threatening with the pistol and demanding a beer mug. In short, I now stood there as a completely disreputable scoundrel. At that moment, I actually regretted that I had not shared the fate of my dear comrades at the Feldherrnhalle. The most shameful of all was that the men who had worked with us all this time, now that we couldn't defend ourselves, as we were lying in prisons, some of us physically broken ourselves, were now coming up with lies upon lies. I never gave Kahr my word. And he now publicly states in the newspapers that I gave him my word of honor. It is not true. I never gave Lossow and Seisser my word not to do anything, but I said that I was loyally behind them, that I would not do anything against them. In the end, I even said in a retraction, "Gentlemen, if you do not bring it to a decision now, I no longer consider myself bound in my decisions." But I did nothing against the gentlemen. What I did was not contrary to considerations of loyalty. I acted loyally towards them right up to the moment when our people went down in a hail of bullets. It is outrageous that at the moment when we could not defend ourselves, these most infamous lies were spread. The gentlemen knew that our deed did not rob us of the hearts of our supporters. That is why they wanted to rob us of our honor and the reputation of our members. At that moment, I really didn't want to know anything more of this lying and slanderous world. And when, in the course of the next few days, during the second week, this campaign of slander continued, and when one after the other people were brought to Landsberg, all of whom I knew were innocent, whose only guilt was that they belonged to our movement, who knew nothing of the matter, who were only arrested because they shared our opinions, and the authorities feared that these opinions would be expressed, then I made the decision to defend myself and to fight to the last breath. That is why I have entered the courtroom. Not to deny anything or to deny responsibility. No, I am protesting against Lieutenant Colonel Kriebel, declaring that he is responsible for what happened. He has no responsibility. I alone bear it. I alone wanted the matter in the end. The other gentlemen only acted with me. I am convinced that I did not want anything bad. I bear the responsibility and will also bear all the consequences. But I must say one thing. I am not a criminal because of this. And I do not feel like a criminal because of this. On the contrary, if I am now more or less reproached as to how I, of all people, could come to do such a thing, since I do not even have Bavarian citizenship, I must say the following. I do not have the citizenship of the present state, but I once acquired citizenship in the state that was Germany for me, namely the German army. I received the national diploma in my military passport, which directs me to the district office of Munich. And if the day should ever come when I am assigned this responsibility, then I will know where I belong. Secondly, if I do not get naturalized as a German citizen, it is because I know that it is bitter when one has to renounce one's fatherland in order to be German. But I believe and hope that the time will come when German citizenship rights will extend beyond fragmented and petty borders, from Königsberg to Strasbourg, and from Hamburg to Vienna. But it seems to me easy for a weak-minded administrator to expel a superior man, just as it is easy for a superior rogue to escape justice. I am convinced that it would be unprincipled for a man who stakes his blood to have a certificate issued by a Berliner who, in my eyes, does not deserve to be German or is not German at all. From my youth, I have never felt Austrian. Individual Austrians really can't help what our ruling house has done in German history. On the contrary, as a pan-Germanist, I fought against this ruling house in my youth. The day must also come when Austria becomes part of Germany, and it would be disgraceful if I, who advocated this the most, were to renounce my homeland in order to acquire a right of citizenship. That is a mere empty phrase, since it cannot be affirmed any better than I have affirmed it. I have defended the right of citizenship as an obedient soldier, as well as within the homeland, without grumbling. If I stand here as a revolutionary, I stand here as a revolutionary against the revolution. I myself cannot plead guilty. I confess to the deed, but I cannot plead guilty to high treason, because there is no high treason against the traitors of 1918. It is impossible that I have committed high treason, because it cannot lie in the deeds of November 8th and 9th, 1923, but in the whole attitude and in the whole action of the months before. It does not lie in a single deed, but in the discussions on this deed beforehand. If I really did commit treason, I am surprised that those who did the same as me at that time are not sitting by my side. I cannot plead guilty, since I know that the public prosecutor himself is legally obliged to bring charges against those who committed the same crime as we did and also discussed it with us. I mean Herr von Berchem, von Aufsess, Carr, Lossow, Seisser, and all the others. That the public prosecutor has not brought charges against these gentlemen must be a mistake. I confess, as I have said, to the crime and deny any guilt, as long as the same is not applied to the gentlemen who wanted the same thing as us and planned it in meetings, which can be shown privately. As long as these gentlemen are not beside me, I reject the guilt of high treason. I do not feel that I am a traitor, but the best German who wanted the best for his people. I now ask the judge to address to me such questions as he deems necessary.